This episode of The Biggest Table is brought to you in part by Wild Goose Coffee. Since 2008, Wild Goose has sought to build better communities through coffee. And for our listeners, Wild Goose is offering a special promotion of 20% off a one-time order using the code TABLE at checkout. To learn more and to order coffee, please visit wildgoosecoffee.com. In this conversation, I have a rich conversation with Chris Smith of Inglewood Review of Books. We cover a range of topics, starting with his own personal journey of food over the past 10 years. But we spend the majority of our time using a couple of Chris's books, namely Slow Church and How the Body of Christ Talks, to dialogue about the importance of conversation for the health of ourselves and our community. Through the recovery of conversation, we begin to see how God wants to collaborate with us in his work of redemption. Enjoy the episode. Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Biggest Table. I am your host, Andrew Camp, and in this podcast, we explore the table, food, eating, and hospitality as an arena for experiencing God's love and our love for one another. And today, I'm excited to be joined by Chris Smith. Chris Smith is the founding editor of the Inglewood Review of Books, which you can access at inglewoodreview.org. He and his wife, Jenny, have three adult children and are members of Inglewood Christian Church on the urban Near East Side of Indianapolis. Chris is the co-author of the award-winning book Slow Church and author of several other books, including most recently, How the Body of Christ Talks, Recovering the Practice of Conversation in the Church. Most of his latest writings end up on the Inglewood Review's Substack, which you can find at theconversationallife.substack.com. Thanks for joining me today, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me, Andrew.
Yeah, no, always have enjoyed your work, and so I'm excited to explore food and conversation, as we are entering into this time. And so to begin us, just curious, what role has food played in your life growing up and as an adult? How would you characterize your relationship to food?
Well, that's a great question. A big question. Probably could spend an hour or more just talking about that. But to keep it brief, I mean, I've always enjoyed food. My mom was a good cook. My grandparents had a family farm, and kind of through spending summers on their farm, really kind of had an opportunity to see a lot of different sides of agriculture and just that sort of intimate connection with food and land, and that certainly has stuck with me through the years. I think maybe something that we could talk about, but something more recent, I guess, is that probably over the last decade or so, probably about a decade ago, a little less than a decade ago, I had become really unhealthy in the ways that I was eating, just not paying attention to what I was eating and just eating what I wanted to eat. Eventually, in a person's life, that'll catch up to them. And it caught up to me, and I was fairly significantly overweight. And so over the last decade, I never really liked dieting. I don't really like the idea of dieting. And honestly, the science has showed that for a lot of people, it's not even particularly effective. I mean, it's effective for helping them to lose weight, but not necessarily to be sustainable and keep that weight off. So I've really tried to kind of pursue healthier eating habits, trying to eat more plant-based, not exclusively plant-based, but kind of leaning into a diet that is more plant-based and mostly eliminated red meat. Those sorts of things, and kind of learning a lot along the way, reading a lot of different folks. From Michael Pollan's kind of food rules and just kind of thinking about just kind of some basic philosophy and basic principles of what a healthy food is, kind of not less processed food, more, he talks about more foods from around the outside of the grocery store, yep. Produce and so forth. I'm learning a lot along that way, and kind of more recently, just within the last 6 months or so, kind of been introduced to the work of Stephen Gundry, wrote a book called The Plant Paradox. And he's saying that even though kind of plant-based eating is probably the best for most folks these days, not all plants are created equal. And he kind of identifies foods called lectins, which is a protein that kind of interferes with the normal functioning of our gut bacteria and actually can prompt cravings for carbohydrates and sugars and also just kind of help or inhibit the healthy functioning of our stomachs, and which has a lot of kind of effects. So anyway, all that. So kind of been learning a lot and still kind of learning a lot about eating and really all the way through, and part of the journey of learning to eat more healthfully over the last 8 to 10 years or whatever, has really been driven by the fact that the reality that I love to eat and I don't want to be miserable eating. I want to eat in ways that are more healthful, but try to do that in ways that I still really enjoy the foods I'm eating. So that's kind of been a conversation of sorts trying things and reading things and interacting with them and really trying to figure out what works for me and what is most healthiest for the life that I'm leading, a life which work-wise is fairly sedentary, but I'm also a runner and a distance coach for high school students, so can't cut back too much on my calorie intake because I'm also burning a significant amount in those endeavors.
So as you reflect on this personal journey of 8 to 10 years, like, how has that then informed your life more holistically? Because what I've appreciated about your work is you're not a siloed thinker. You want to bring everything into conversation with each other.
I mean, I think there's a couple things that really stand out there. That's again an excellent question and a excellent. I mean, you've known me for probably most of those 8 to 10 years, maybe longer. I can't remember, but yeah, a couple of things really stand out. I mean, one is, I mean, we're always eating in community. I mean, again, the slow food movement, I've learned a lot about that, about kind of the social dynamics around agriculture that brings the food to our table and eating closer to our homes, but also the social dynamics of the home and the shared table. And so the experiments that I've had that I described with kind of learning to eat more healthfully have not been in a vacuum. They've always been, I mean, we, as part of a church community that shares life together pretty thickly. And I mean, we're always sharing meals together and there's a lot of diversity in our congregation in terms of what people's preferred or necessary diets are and restrictions and preferences and all of those sorts of things. And that's really kind of helped kind of crack my tendency toward idealism. And again, it's a conversation. You learn to try to, how do I, as a member of this community that is going to share meals together, how do I, give and receive hospitality? Mm-hmm. And how do I learn to eat in ways that are helpful to me, but also, not loving and respectful toward my siblings here. My spouse has her own sort of kind of journey toward eating more healthfully. And I mean, I won't talk about that here, but it's not the same, quite exactly the same. And it hasn't been on exactly the same timetable as mine either. So what does it look like for, I mean, we're right now, within the last couple of years, we've just become a kind of two-person household. And if we don't have anything else going on, we're going to eat together. And so what does it mean to share meals together when you're maybe on a little bit different pages of kind of what sorts of things you're eating, even if you are generally moving in a similar direction. So that's one thing that really stands out. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other thing too is just, and I've actually been writing a little bit about this week. I'm working on a little book right now, which is kind of out of the stream of what I've often been writing, thinking about, but it's kind of based in my coaching and kind of thinking about athletic performance more holistically and thinking about the ways that kind of so many things outside, I mean, regardless of what sport you're doing, whether it's basketball or distance running or swimming or biking or whatever, soccer, I mean, you're going to have your training, but you have so many other facets of life that really do affect your performance and your capacity to be able to train. And certainly diet is part of that. And so diet is connected to sleep. It's connected to breathing. It's connected to so many facets of life. I mean, just connected to, our emotional lives and just the amount of energy we have and the energy that we bring to the work that we do and to the relationships that we have. A big part of learning to live more healthfully for me, I mean, it wasn't just that I could be a better person, but it was that really, particularly that sort of, well, I mean, the holistic sense, but particularly the sort of energy of it, just having more energy. Part of my kind of story with part of the impetus for learning to eat and be more healthful was that my blood pressure was dangerously high, and I didn't even know it probably for several years before it was actually diagnosed. And it meant that I would get winded going up a flight of stairs and right. I just didn't have as much energy at the end of the day or in the evenings, even late afternoons. And so part of the journey of learning to be more healthful in my eating has been one of really trying to be able to have a little bit more energy for the work that I do and to be able to, I mean, one of the kind of outgrowths of that journey is this sort of coaching that I've been doing for about 3 years now at the high school in our neighborhood.
Right. Yeah. And just wonder, you said a lot. there's some great points there, but what I loved too is you mentioned it's sort of transformed hospitality for you for the giving and the receiving, which sure. I'm sure the receiving aspect might be harder because you can't control. When you're on the receiving end of hospitality, you're not in a place of control,
sure.
Of what happens or what you put in your body at times.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, and so how has that factored in as you think about community? Like, how do you receive hospitality as one who is entering into more of a plant-based diet?
Sure. Now, again, like I said, I'm not a vegan. It's kind of a trajectory, I guess, in terms of plant-based eating. You eat what is served to you. I mean, maybe sometimes you say no thank you if it's something that, or you just eat smaller portions.
Right.
Have a snack afterwards or something. It's tricky. Again, I really value the opportunity to give and receive hospitality and just generally my personality is not one of being legalistic in any way or in many ways. There probably are things that I'm legalistic about, I guess, as we all are. Learning to be gracious and to be flexible and to find ways that kind of fit with your needs. And I mean, graciously, a lot of folks that we share meals with fairly regularly, I mean, they know the journey that I'm on. They know that I don't very often eat red meat. And I mean, that's kind of one of the main ones. And they actually find ways to accommodate that. I mean, again, that's all conversations. I mean, obviously if I'm eating with somebody new, in their home or whatever, I'm going to extend more grace just because they don't really know, the journey that I'm on. They don't know who I am. It's tricky. I think there's some wisdom in just kind of learning to eat the things that are set before you. And again, you don't necessarily have to like them, and you don't have to kind of eat huge portions of them. I think part of the nature of receiving hospitality is being willing to be a little bit adventurous and a little bit flexible in terms of what you're eating, even if it's not necessarily things that you would prefer to eat.
No, and it all comes back to sort of a conversation, you know, with your body, conversation with your community, you know, and a lot of what
conversation with science in some sense in what do we know about how our bodies function and what is best for our bodies. And again, within all the sorts of particularities of kind of the demands that we put on our bodies by our work and our recreational activities and our family commitments and all of those sorts of things.
And so conversation has obviously, you know, that the ideas of conversation are near and dear to your work, which you've done.
Absolutely.
You know, and so like, as you think about slow church, you know, and, that thought, you know, I was just looking back, the book came out 10 years ago, which sort of models, which is crazy.
It's absolutely crazy.
You know, but slow church is a conversation, you know, that you and your co-author John wanted to participate in. And so like, what's the vision behind slow church?
Yeah, it's, slow church was inspired by the slow food movements. But really, trying to find a way of being church, that is centered around the table, of course, a very Eucharistic, sort of sense. But particularly, in the economy of sharing that happens around the table, sharing of food, sharing of stories, sharing of our lives, sharing of other resources, that happens through conversations at the table. So that's the gist of it fundamentally. And I've had some conversations, with, Andy Root about this. I actually did a podcast episode with Andy and John Swinton. I was a little bit frustrated, that Andy, doesn't seemingly know what slow food is or doesn't have a deep understanding of the slow food movement. And in such, he's pretty critical of the idea of slow church, in his book. I'm trying to look. The Congregation in the Secular Age actually has a chapter on that. I'm sure you're familiar with that chapter as well. Because slow church and slow food, for that matter, isn't really about slowness as we think of slowness. It is actually about what the German sociologist Hartmut Rosa calls resonance. And I didn't, when we wrote Slow Church, I didn't have access to Rosa's work. It hadn't been translated into English yet. But this notion of resonance, of really kind of, finding one's place, finding, abundant life, we might talk about in terms of language that's biblical, is what slow church is about. And in order to find that abundant life, we have to slow down a bit, because, moving so fast, as our culture moves so fast, one of Rosa's big things, I mean, is the acceleration of society. Mm-hmm. And he does a wonderful book. Hijab is kind of his landmark work, is a book called Social Acceleration. For listeners that aren't familiar with that, I would encourage you to check that out. Andy Root is probably the biggest kind of theological interpreter of Rosa's work, and certainly The Congregation in a Secular Age, the book that I was mentioning earlier, is a great sort of introduction to that. But Andy and I had a great conversation about that, and I really tried to needle him a bit, that really kind of what Slow Church was about was about resonance, about this kind of thing that's central to kind of what he was encouraging congregations to seek. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's about, I mean, certainly the gospel of Jesus is about abundant life, or, I mean, oftentimes the phrase eternal life, the Greek word for that, which I'm drawing a blank on right now at the top of my head, but is as much qualitative as it is quantitative, and could often be, in many cases in the New Testament, could be translated abundant life. Hmm. And how do we find that abundant life stems from the relationships that we have in community. And that's what we very intentionally chose the language of slow church, not slow faith or slow Christianity or anything like that, but slow church, because we really wanted to emphasize that this is something that is experienced in community, in relationship, kind of as we already talked about when we were talking about hospitality.
Yeah.
That it's not just certainly we experience it personally, but we experience it personally within the context of a community.
Mm-hmm. You know, and at once, you know, the slow church ideas and the slow food movement, it's universal, but very particular. Mm-hmm. And you guys hammer down on that of like, okay, there's some universal ideas that need to be expressed particularly versus a McDonaldization of the church where it's copycat or, you know, it all looks the same.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. Yeah. I'm increasingly skeptical of universals. I mean, other than perhaps some really basic things like God's creation, the very fact that God created. But I'm constantly reminded of the rich diversity of what God has created, and really skeptical of the damage and wary of the damage we do when we really try to force things into universal principles. So if there is a universal principle in slow church, it's being critical of kind of the sort of a one size fits all universal ways that we've received things in the modern age, the last 500 years or so, and the being critical of that mentality and critical of all the sorts of damage it's done, kind of racially, economically, ecologically, of course. But really beginning to make sense of the world and make sense of life from the particular bodies that we have and the particular social bodies that we're part of, particular communities that we belong to, the church and the home and the neighborhood, especially. And then kind of thinking and imagining the world outward from there, rather than kind of starting from the top down and kind of universal conceptions of what the world is.
Yeah. So it's starting with the particulars of your community.
Yeah. I mean, even more so than that, starting with the particulars of your own body, right, and your own sort of histories that you have from your genetics and epigenetics and your parents and the places where they lived and the sort of ethnic and genetic sorts of histories that were united to create you as a particular person.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I mean, working outward from there, I mean, right. obviously already we're starting to look at communities by the communities, even the genetic familial communities that we're embedded in.
Yeah. I never thought about that, of like, what story do I bring to the community, you know, and what's...
Sure. No, absolutely. Know. And again, I think I play with that a little bit more in How the Body of Christ Talks.
Right.
Because, I mean, I mean, you're very familiar with that book, but I love the image of the body, and particularly the way that it holds intention and holds together the particular of unique body parts that have unique functions, but they don't function apart from the body. They function in and for the health and well-being of the body. And if they don't, if they're not functioning, they necessarily function in the body, but if they're not functioning for the body, then you have a serious problem. You have serious disease. And right. that happens. That's in a sense what cancer is. You have cells that are destroying other cells, and it's deadly. I think too often it's really easy. And I think maybe there were times when I was writing Slow Church, and maybe even more recently than that, that it's really easy to get kind of let the pendulum swing too far into the social, and really kind of lose the reality of that we are unique persons, created by God and gifted distinctively and personally, by God. And it's not just to make me a better person. And it's not for me to get as rich as I can and, right. suck the marrow out of life, as it were, but it's for, it's to be shared and, to be shared for the health and well-being of, and the flourishing of the communities to which we belong, and to be shared generously.
Yeah. No, and you and I were just talking about Kathy Kahn's book, Loving Disagreement.
Sure, absolutely. It was the Englewood Review's book of the year for 2023.
Yeah, and it was a great book. You know, and she and Matt, her co-author, talked a lot about the fact.
It's right here on my desk.
Yep. You know, just that the fruit of the Spirit is for the sake of the community. You know,
oh, absolutely.
It's not for me to grow, but that as I get to know my body, it's for the sake of the community and to move closer into proximity with others, you know? And so what role does proximity then begin to play, in sure. life?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, again, we were kind of saying, I didn't use the word earlier, but I mean, I'm a localist. I'm kind of what we described of kind of, moving outward from our bodies into communities is fundamentally a way of proximity, of learning to pay attention to what is closest at hand, and trying to see the world from that perspective. Instead of thinking socio-politically here, but instead of kind of taking up issues in the abstract because they seem like good ideas. I mean, that's certainly well-intentioned but really looking at that, at my particular community and what are the challenges that my community faces? What are the injustices, that my neighbors, or even myself, maybe in some cases, are laboring under, and how do we begin to actually address those real issues, in the concrete particularity of them, not just kind of as abstract, sorts of issues of political issues or whatever. But really trying to, engage, on the basis of, real injustices that are having detrimental effects on real bodies.
No, for sure. Yeah. Cause again, you know, in Loving Disagreement, they talk that shalom is for everyone, you know, and not just for the select few. And that might mean as we address the particular injustices of a community, it's giving up or sacrificing, you know, my power, my own self for the good of the community versus just abstract thoughts.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a problem that we have in the American democratic system, and particularly kind of since it's been given rise to by kind of modern European liberalism, individualism, that our tendency is to enter into our democratic republic on the basis of what's best for me. And I mean, that's not the gospel. But rather it's, what's best for the communities that I'm embedded. And as Wendell Berry likes to say, I'm going to totally butcher, but there's one of his poems where he talks about, kind of the desires that we have for our community. We can see that other people have similar desires for their communities, even if kind of the ways that we pursue them and kind of the ends that those desires lead to may be different in different places, but we can at least appreciate that the desires that we have for our community may be similar to in line with the fact that other people in other places have desires for their communities, hopes and dreams and visions.
Mm-hmm. Well, no. And then even within one's own community, there can be different and competing visions of flourishing, or what does flourishing look like? And that requires the conversation to ensue. And conversation in today's culture feels hard, to say the least, right? How do we begin to have a conversation then as a community for what our community can and possibly look like?
Sure. I mean, I think the place to start is the reality that however poorly we're doing it, almost every church community, there are conversations already happening. There are spaces in which people do talk together. And again, it may not be always very healthy kind of conversations, but there are Sunday school classes and committee meetings and board meetings and all of those sorts of things, small groups, all those sorts of things where people are already having conversations. And I think the place to start is really kind of leaning into those and recognizing that we are having conversations there. And how do we do that in ways that that are more healthy? And particularly, I think one of the elements of health that we're often not very attentive to is the dynamics of hierarchy. And in terms of kind of, and I mean, there's dynamics of power, obviously related to hierarchy and who gets to have a say at the table, and who are the people that are listened to and whose voices are given more preference than others. I mean, those sorts of dynamics are really difficult, and they're shaped by lots of factors. I mean, including race and education and perceived leadership and maybe actual titles of leadership. So for us at Englewood, kind of in our practices of conversation, a big part of that has really been trying to unmask the desires that we have for hierarchy. And I don't know that kind of, I mean, I think that's still a work in progress. I don't know that we've done it perfectly, but we really have become attentive over the years to some of the power dynamics, and really seen conversation as a way that we can learn to be together in less hierarchical sorts of ways, and learn to kind of make decisions more in ways that are more like consensus and not just kind of more heavily authoritarian sorts of decisions and discernments.
Yeah, no, the place of hierarchy, you know, and I think a lot of times people come to conversation thinking they have the answers versus a listening posture.
Absolutely.
You know, and so how do we begin to even listen well to those voices? You know, and I think of myself, you know, I'm a white middle-class male, you know, so I'm at times the poster boy of privilege, you know, like,
sure.
But, how do we in positions of power begin to listen well to our community versus coming in with a heavy hand thinking we have all the answers?
Sure. I mean, I think a big part of that is, I mean, creating habits of listening to people on the margins of our community and really listening, not just kind of, checking a box, which unfortunately a lot of kind of, practices of diversity and inclusion, tend to, get boiled down to, oh, we've got to do that. We see this a lot in community development sorts of worlds, that, whatever community development organization is planning a project, planning a residential project or a mixed use project, and community listening is kind of part of the process, but so often it becomes just kind of a box to check, and there's not really listening to the community. It's just we gave folks an opportunity to have their say, but it wasn't really kind of, and then we did what we wanted to. Right. It's often the kind of follow up to the unspoken sort of follow up to that. But really, building friendships, with people for whatever reason that are on the margins of our faith communities, margins of our neighborhoods, whether that's economically or, gender-wise or racially, ethnically, all of those sorts of things. But putting ourselves in places where we can really listen and learn over the long haul and really build meaningful friendships. And that those sorts of habits we'll bring those with us when we have conversations in our churches.
Yeah. And so as we do this, then what role can the table and even food and hospitality, like, and not just as a metaphor, you know, but like,
sure. You know, actual table,
the actual table, yeah. Like how can that be a great equalizer in this process?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's a great question. Certainly being willing, as we were talking earlier about receiving hospitality, being willing to sit at somebody's table and to have them serve you the foods that are meaningful to them and meaningful to the sorts of families and places and cultures that they have come from. And is a really meaningful sort it built some pretty strong bonds and really goes a long way to cultivating friendships. And again, I mean, obviously, I mean, the table itself also, as kind of the slow food movement has reminded us, I mean, it is a place where conversations happen, we really have an opportunity. People are a little bit more relaxed, and are able to share. I mean, obviously, the food that is shared is a part of our persons and our culture that we're sharing together. But we also have opportunities to share stories and to share perspectives, to learn from one another. I think We talk in the Slow Church book a bit about just kind of the nature and kind of the economics section of the book. We talk about kind of economies work best when there's a sort of mutuality, where there's, as we said kind of earlier, when we're talking about hospitality, both a giving and a receiving. But oftentimes in order for you to get to that point of mutuality, of being able to give and receive, oftentimes those of us like myself or yourself, those that are kind of perceived to have some degree of cultural power, oftentimes have to be on the receiving end for a while, the listening end, the attentive end, in order to be able to cultivate the sort of trust that allows. Trust is a big part of, certainly for us, you probably heard me say this many times over the years, but the best fruits of our practices of conversation here at Englewood is that we are learning to and growing in our trust of one another. And it's our trust of one another that really allows us to have these sorts of economies where we're able to really listen to one another and to really share with one another across some significant divides, political divides, economic divides, ethnic divides.
Mm-hmm. No, and it does take time, and it is that posture of receptivity that I know for myself, and as I think about church, like that we need to adopt more, you know, we want to give hospitality to others, you know, whereas are we willing to step into another person's home and receive what they have to offer as a guest versus always trying to be a host?
Sure. There's a lot to learn from Jesus there, that Jesus oftentimes, I mean, Jesus was without a home. He had no place to lay his. So almost any time you see Jesus eating a meal, he's eating in somebody else's house. Mm-hmm. And certainly now a lot of those folks are Jewish, and there's there's all kind of dietary laws that they kind of mostly adhere to. And that would have a bit of a uniformity toward the sorts of foods that were served. But I'm sure there was some diversity and some unexpected sorts of things, because Jesus did eat with a lot of a wide economic variety. Right. And I'm sure across that economic diversity, there was a variety of quality of foods that he was served. As best we can tell from the gospel narratives, Jesus ate what was served, and people appreciated and trusted him and really respected him because of that sort of receptivity of being able to kind of receive the hospitality that they offered to him.
Mm-hmm. No, and the personhood of the person that he received it from, I think, seemed to matter more, because that's what got him in trouble isn't what he ate, but who he ate with, you know, and becoming ritually unclean. You know, he would have been ritually unclean.
Sure.
I think probably 99% to 100% of his life, you know, which had huge issues in, you know, would have played a major role in how he could participate in his religious culture.
But I think one of the things I've really appreciated that I think I've learned from Walter Brueggemann's work, particularly with, as an Old Testament scholar and kind of looking at kind of ancient Israelite culture, was the tension between tension not necessarily in a helpful way, between kind of purity and neighborliness. Mm-hmm. And that, certainly we kind of see that kind of played out in Jesus' interactions with the Pharisees, and that the Pharisees were kind of really driven by visions of purity. And certainly it's not difficult to see the ways that a lot of folks today are kind of driven by unhelpful visions of purity, of whiteness and mm-hmm. purity of what America is assumed to be. for instance. But really, neighborliness for Brueggemann and neighborliness as he kind of sees him through the person of Jesus is really about, is a way of talking about kind of what we've already said of being willing to receive hospitality and to eventually to enter into this sort of friendship in which there is a mutuality of mm-hmm. of giving and receiving, and care for one another that goes both ways and really kind of respects the unique sorts of personhood of all those involved.
Yeah, you know, and tagging on to what you said, it's not being afraid of contamination, you know, like we get
sure. Yeah, exactly. That's
purity leads to an idea that we're going to be contaminated by the other, whereas Jesus shows us like his presence is stronger,
sure,
you know, and will enable more love, you know, and more neighborliness when we get past that fear of the other.
Sure. And I think just kind of to think kind of I'm not an expert on this, but to kind of think sociologically and ecologically about kind of all the ways that we're kind of contaminated already, just by exposure to pollution in the air and pollution in the water and pollution in the land and, unhealthy sorts of foods. I think a lot of our conceptions of purity, yeah. Are really, grounded in delusions, are grounded in, misinformation and false conceptions of, what the world is. I think we live in a broken world and we participate in a broken world and while yes, we should be kind of seeking justice in that world. I mean, oftentimes, as we've said, for the sake of hospitality, there are going to be ways that we might kind of contaminate our ideals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not to be, again, to enter into the mess, you know, and I think that's a lot of your work is grounded in this idea that we have to be willing to enter into the mess of life.
Sure.
You know, and, you know, even as you talk about the body, like, you know, when our body is out of whack, you know, or if we're in disease, sometimes getting better involves a lot of pain and mess sure. before there is health and flourishing.
Sure. I mean, even our conceptions of our bodies are much more complex and messy than we think. I mean, we think we have this skin that surrounds our bodies and that it's a membrane, but well, I mean, membrane is probably a better word for it because yeah. all kinds of substances and are coming and going, and we really exist as kind of a network of cells that are inherited and shaped by our environment as well as our genetics and by those people in close proximity to us. And mm-hmm. I mean, certainly we learned a lot about that during the COVID-19 pandemic,
right.
And the effects of not paying attention to the ways that diseased cells kind of infiltrate our bodies and the large scale effects that can have. But we're always, it's been proven as a bit of a myth, but just kind of this notion that kind of all of the cells in our bodies kind of regenerate within some period of time. Some people say 7 years sometimes, but the cells in our bodies are always kind of dying and being replaced. And that's, again, kind of a part of the messiness of who we are. And even as we kind of think about kind of what a body is, what a person is, it's not, I mean, just from a biological level, it's not nearly as neat as we might imagine it to be. And so, and that's kind of what leads me to really emphasize that we are conversational bodies. The title of How the Body of Christ Talks at one time was going to be Conversational Bodies. My publisher didn't like that quite as well. They thought it was a little bit harder to wrap your mind around. But the sense that the sort of social life that we should have as conversational is really shaped by our existence as bodies that are always in flux and always existing in a sort of conversation, not only the sort of familiar conversation that's happening at the neurological level, but this sort of kind of cellular conversation of kind of cells entering our body and some of them needing to be resisted and some of them actually being quite healthful for us. So,
right. Wow, I think we could keep on talking for a long time all about this. No,
sure we could.
But as we begin to think about wrapping up, a question I've enjoyed talking to other people about and asking and hearing their point is this question of what is the story you want the church to tell?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I'll answer it with a non-answer, I think.
Perfect.
I think particularly one of the deepest temptations of our day is the church or Christian people trying to force our stories on the world. I mean, fundamentally, that's kind of the nature of Christian nationalism,
right.
And which isn't a new thing. It's basically kind of the latest incarnation of Christendom, of kind of believing that Christianity needs to be in control, in control of the world at a large scale or at smaller scales as well. So, I don't know. I mean, certainly, I mean, if there is a story, I mean, it's kind of what you alluded to earlier, that God has created us as unique human beings and loves us immensely in all of our uniqueness, and the work, the sort of incarnational work that God has created us for is this sort of conversation of learning and learning to be with and to share life with and to be in friendship and mutuality and an economy of care and sharing with those people closest to us, but not in a sort of tribalistic sort of way, but in a way that that kind of abundantly overflows our local communities to our cities and to the world at large.
Yeah.
A little bit hesitant about kind of the way stories are used at the present. Mm. I mean, I guess there probably is a story there, but it's a different sort of story.
Yeah.
It's a story about, it's fundamentally a gospel story.
Mm-hmm. And you alluded to it, but it's, instead of telling a story, it's listening to the story of your community.
Sure, sure. And receiving the nature. I mean, I think, again, kind of going back to this nature or to the notion that God really desires to collaborate with humanity. I mean, that's the nature of incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
It's the nature of our identity as the church and as churches. And that's, I mean, I think fundamentally that's the posture that we carry into our neighborhoods, that it's not we have everything figured out. It's that we want to work together and you are neighbors are loved and you are immensely gifted. And we don't want to take your gifts and use them for our own glory, but we want to work together so that this place can flourish and that we all can share in the benefits of the goodness of who each of us is and the sorts of goodness of social bodies that are coming into existence, in which these things can all be shared.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Chris. It's always good to talk, you know, to you, and I just your wisdom and yeah, the conversations we've shared over the years and the friendship even that's developed, just really appreciate you and what you're doing. You know, you've cost me a lot of money through Inglewood Review of Books, but you know, it's also been my source of what to read next, you know? And so, yeah, if you're not familiar with Inglewood Review of Books, please visit Inglewood Review of Books, and just always some great books to be aware of through Chris. And so just as we end, a few fun questions I like to ask my guests, just about food. Mm-hmm. So what's one food you refuse to eat?
Ooh, I probably have lots. The one that most comes to mind first is Brussels sprouts. I think that I've had some bad experiences with Brussels sprouts over the years. Okay. It's just one vegetable. I've struggled to eat vegetables over the years, completely honestly, which is kind of odd in that I'm kind of learning to eat more plant-based now. There's a bit of irony there, but especially Brussels sprouts. Hmm. I think that's one food that has been really difficult for me.
Okay.
I guess I would eat it if it was served to me, but I probably wouldn't eat very much of it.
Have you ever had fried Brussels sprouts? Where you flash fry them instead, like, you know, versus the mushiness that I think most people associate with?
Yeah, maybe I think I've had air fried.
Okay.
Brussels sprouts. I don't know that I've had kind of deep fried.
Yeah.
Brussels sprouts. But
gotcha.
But okay. usually roasted is kind of, I think, how we've made them. They're not mushy.
No,
but it's just the taste of them, the texture. I'm a kind of a big texture person.
Okay.
In my eating habits, and so I have weird things that that I don't necessarily like because of having bad experiences with the texture of it.
I understand. So on the other end of the spectrum, what's the best thing you've ever eaten?
Oh, yeah. Oof. I don't know. I've eaten a lot of things in my day. I'm not a gourmet person,
right.
But yeah, I'm kind of drawing a blank, but I mean, I love home cooked foods. I just actually celebrated my 50th birthday, and our kind of small group from our church got together, and kind of one of the traditions that we have in our small group, is that if it's a person's birthday in a week, they get to choose kind of what we're eating. My friend Ben, who's in our small group, he and his family, he's a really good cook, and he makes a good chili. And so I asked him if he could make chili for us. So
nice.
And that actually it's a chili with red meat. But it's, hey, you're only turned 50 once.
Exactly.
But yeah, that was really delicious, and it's kind of the first thing and kind of a recent thing that comes to mind.
Fun. And then finally, there's a conversation among chefs about last meals, like as in, if you knew you had one last meal to enjoy, what would it be? You know, do you have, if you knew you only had one last meal to enjoy, do you know what you would choose and why?
I don't know. I think it would be, I think there's probably some contextual things that would help me kind of make that sort of decision. I mean, I think I'm a big, again, kind of in contrast to what I've been saying about eating plant-based and trying to avoid red meat. I really do like a good cheesesteak. I come from the East Coast. Maybe I would have a cheesesteak if it was my last meal and knew I was going to die anyway. I might really have a good cheesesteak with some fried peppers and onions. And I'm not a cheese whiz. There's kind of a big sort of several schools of cheesesteaks in southeastern Pennsylvania. and I'm not a cheese steak or cheese whiz on your cheese steak type person. I'm more a provolone type cheese on your cheese steak. But yeah, maybe that's what I'd have.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Chris, for joining us, joining me on this episode. And, you know, yeah, I would encourage you as a listener to explore the Inglewood Review of Books and Chris's Substack, which is The Conversational Life. And we'll make sure all these links are in the show notes. But yeah, if you've enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing it with others. Thanks for joining us on this episode of The Biggest Table, where we explore what it means to be transformed by God's love around the table and through food. Until next time, bye.